Hi, you're listening to the My Cricket Coach Show, and you can find us at pitchvision.com. My name's David Hinchliffe in the UK.
I'm Kevin Sampath from Australia. Well, we've been away for a while now. And
welcome back, Kevin.
Welcome back to you too. We've been up to different things, David. It's winter here, and we can sort of do a bit. It's not as cold as it would get in the UK, but you're into your season, aren't you?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I've played two games. The last couple of shows we've had interviews, haven't we? So
we haven't had
a chance really to catch up and find out what we've been doing respectively. So I suppose I've been a bit busier on the cricket front than you, it's the cricket season here. So what have you been up to? What have you been doing to fill those long winter nights?
I'm happy that there is some sort of cricket on. I've been watching the IPL.
Oh yeah.
And when I'm not watching the IPL, I head down to the Nets on the weekends, have a hit out with a few mates.
Yeah.
That's been keeping me busy as well. But the IPL has been a revelation to me. I mean, I've learned a lot of new things.
Really?
And I've taken a lot of tips to take back to the Nets.
So that's interesting. We'll find out what those are in a minute. What I tend to notice, or what I've noticed recently with international tournaments, is usually with these big tournaments, something comes up, or two or three new little things come up that people are trying to see what works and what doesn't work. I remember in the last World Cup, the big thing was the wicketkeeper standing up to the medium pacers again after a long period where wicketkeepers would just stand back to pretty much any speed apart from spinners. And that's become a trend now, where keepers stand up pretty much as they can.
Yeah.
So have you noticed any trends in the IPL of new things, people trying new things that haven't been tried before?
Well, one thing I've really noticed, especially on the South African pitches, is the use of the quicker ball. And it's not just a quicker ball, it's much more an effort ball. So it really rushes the batsman, and it hits the batsman's bat hard, so he can't really complete his shot well enough. And one player I've seen do this really well is Callis. Now, Callis isn't the fastest bowler in the world, but he definitely is one of the most... He's probably the smartest bowler I've ever watched. And because of his pace, he's become vulnerable to the batsman. Like, everyone wants to have a slog, but Callis has used his pace smartly. Like, I've seen, especially against the sloggers like Jayasurya or whoever, he has this ball where he really bends his back a little bit more, and everything else about his run-up, the rhythm is the same. Except as he approaches the crease, he bends his back a little bit more and gets a little bit more out of the pitch. So it sort of bounces a bit more. It rushes the batsman a bit more, and the batsmen sort of get confused. So from then on, the batsmen are expecting him to get that quicker ball out there, and he slips in the slower ball somewhere in there as well. So I've tried that in the Nets a few times, and I have to say it's been working so far, but I found I have to get myself warmed up first for a few balls and then try it. Because if you try it straight away, it goes all haywire.
Yeah, I was going to say that. I mean, I'm not much of a bowler, but I do bowl in the Nets sometimes. And one thing that I notice is when I try and put that little bit of extra effort in, you know, to try and get it down the other end a bit quicker than my normal, I don't know, 45 miles an hour, whatever it is, then it just tends to go down the leg side or wide outside the off stump. How have you found that? Do you just find it's a matter of getting into a rhythm then and then just putting that extra effort in at exactly the right moment rather than putting the extra effort in from the moment you start your run-up, I suppose. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Well, you do have to get into your rhythm first. So probably a few balls or a few overs to get your body used to the way you're bowling. And then probably the effort comes in at the end. But I've also spoken to a few other guys who I go to the Nets with, and they say whenever they try to sort of try a different delivery against a batsman, they don't think about it too much. So if they think about, all right, I'm going to bowl a leg cutter and I want it to land here, and if I stuff it up, then that's a prize gone. Then you're thinking about it too much that you stuff it up anyway in the end. So what they tend to do is they think of it just as just another ball, and as they're up to this crease, they decide, all right, this is what I'm going to do, and this, it's going to land here, and that's what's going to happen. Nothing else is going to happen. So it's sort of a mental thing as well. So it's about the confidence, and I guess that's why international players are so good at it.
Yeah, because it's a lot. I mean, of course, it's, you know, having that extra level of skill so you can execute the skill obviously helps. But yeah, I mean, if you get a bit tense and start to stress about it, then you can't, especially with bowling, well, with any cricket skill really, the more relaxed and in the moment you are about it, the more free flowing your body is, and the better you can do whatever that skill is. I saw a video with Jeremy Snape, who's a sports psychologist now, but for many years he was an all-rounder for Leicestershire, and he played a few times for England as well. And he was doing a sort of a masterclass on spin bowling in 2020 cricket, and his theory was quite interesting in that you don't really need to change anything at all in your run-up or your action if you're going to bowl a slower ball or a quicker ball. The only thing it's just in that split. The only thing you need to change is the speed of the arm in that split second, and everything else should stay exactly the same. So you can bowl two balls that look almost identical, and there can be a dramatic difference in the pace of them, just because one is a slower ball and one is your effort ball. But you put that extra effort in at exactly the right split second, and that's when you do it. And I suppose that applies for seam bowling as much as it does for spin bowling. And then he advanced that even further, one step further, which I thought was quite clever. He then says what you can do then is you can trick the batsman by running up a little bit quicker and sort of scrunching up your face a bit more than you normally would, as if you were going to bowl a quicker ball, and then throw him a dummy and bowl a slower ball, and also do it the other way, so sort of ease up to the crease and look like you're going to bowl a slower ball, and look like there's not a lot of effort going into it, and then whip your arm round as quick as you can. And as long as you get the timing of that right, you sort of double crossing the batsman almost, you know.
Yeah, I saw Brett Lee do the first thing you mentioned most recently in the IPL. He ran up extra fast, and as he bowled, he let out an extra loud grunt. And the ball was about 30 km slower than it normally was, and every time he did it, it fooled the batsman.
Well, yeah, the batsman is looking for those little clues. The better the batsman, the more they look for those little clues, those little indicators as to where the ball's going to be ending up. If you've got a bowler who's tensed up, then there's a good chance that he's going to be trying to put in a bit of extra effort. So if the bowler can upset that natural inclination of the batsman, then that's got to be a good thing for the bowler.
That's right. And I've also noticed, David, going back to the point about trying different deliveries or your quicker or your slower delivery, you see when you watch bowlers bowl in the death, when they have that doubt in their mind about if they're going to land this delivery in the wrong place, it's going to get slogged for a six or whatever, they usually do never, like most of the times, they never land in the right place. I think it's because doubt creeps in, and when their confidence is low, they don't bowl it as
Yeah,
accurately as they
definitely.
want it bowled. And so you've been playing, haven't you, David? How have your two games gone so far?
Pretty good. I played one game for the first team at the start of the season, and then the regular
Nice.
wicketkeeper. Yeah, that was good. That was enjoyable. And then the re regular wicketkeeper came back. The first team wicketkeeper came back, so I was relegated to the second team. The captain of the first team told me it was no reflection on my performance. So, I'm happy with what he said there. So, and we won both our games. Typical sort of early season English conditions. A green wicket that was doing a bit, and a little bit conditions are a little bit damp, and generally low scoring matches all over the country really. And was the case with ours. We with our first game, we only managed 120 in our 50 overs, which proved to be far too many for the opposition because we bowled them out for under 70. And then in the second team game, we did the same thing, except we fielded first, and we bowled them out for 90 something. So it took them 41 overs to get to 90, and we bowled them out, and then we knocked them off in plenty of time. In our league, if you bowl a team out, then you get however many overs are left. So we bowled them out in the 41st over. So we got those extra 9 overs. So we had 59 overs to get 92 runs, and we knocked them off in plenty of time, and only 2 wickets down. So
Oh, it's
it was
pretty
good. I
good.
didn't bat in either of them, but I the highlight, I suppose, was a run out chance that was a very, very simple run out because one person ran and the other one didn't, so they were both up at the wrong end. And the guy who fielded the ball in the covers decided he was going to make it as difficult as possible for me to run him out. And he held the ball, one of those really inaccurate sidearm throws that the top players do really accurately, but club players tend to spray it all over the place. So he held the ball like that, on a sort of half volley bounce. So I had to one handed, I had to catch the, I had to catch the reach out, catch the ball on this kind of half volley bounce, and then bring it back to the stumps. And luckily, I managed to take it cleanly. And then it was once it was in the gloves, then there was no chance for the chap because he was well down. He wouldn't have been in the frame if there was a TV camera there. So two enjoyable wins.
So the two teams that you played, David, did you notice any difference in skill, fitness, in the general way the team played or whatever?
Well, it was more a matter of our own team. Really, the difference between the first team and the second team in skill level and also preparation. The big thing that springs into my mind is when we're warming up before the game, we have this little sort of catching game that we play. We have three rows of players, and someone's hitting the ball up for catches, and you have to. Because the players are in three rows, you have to call for it, and you have to catch it and return it to the wicket keeper, and it's just a nice sort of catching warm up that involves everyone. And when we did it in the first team, pretty much everything was caught, and it all looked very professional and slick, and all the throws were straight back to me, roughly, and where I could get them quite easily. But the second team one was that it was the absolute worst warm up I've ever seen in my life. Catches were being dropped. Throws were being sprayed all over the place. People were just wandering around, not particularly interested. It was a complete shambles, and it wasn't really the fault of, say, the captain. He was trying to get it organised and everything. It just didn't sit. Just I suppose it's because of that skill level difference. That people were just that little bit less, that tiny little bit less bothered about it because it was a second team game. And they just wanted to get on with the match rather than do the required warm-ups. Of course, as what usually happens in these circumstances, we didn't drop a catch, and there was some excellent fielding all round for the entire game. So it just goes to show, just because you warm up badly doesn't mean you can play badly on the pitch. What we were saying, that must have got it all out of the way before we started. So. But you can see the difference. They're very, very much, first team players are, most of them, in most cases anyway, they're very much, they can do everything. When they bat, they all look like they can bat. When they bowl, they all look like they can bowl. Whereas with up and when they field, they all look like they can field. Whereas with the second team players, what you tend to find is they tend to be quite good at one thing, and then the other things maybe are found a little bit wanting. So, the bowlers, are all quite decent, but you don't see them doing much batting. And the batsmen, the top batsmen, are again they all look technically quite good, but maybe half of them are pretty rubbish in the field. And it's just that difference, slight difference. But it's quite interesting playing in both because the intensity is quite a big difference. And I suppose that's one thing you don't get where you are, really. You don't get people moving around between grades that often, do you?
Yeah, no. 'Cause once you're in a grade here, you stick by it for a couple of years until you try out for the next year.
Exactly. So, in many ways, it's quite interesting because you can slip up and down those levels quite quickly. I mean, I've played first team, second team, third team, all in the same season, so. That's quite an interesting side, but it just goes to show, if you put in the effort and you put in the intensity, if you act like a second grade player, even if you're playing third grade, or you act like a first team player, even if you're playing second team, then your chances are of getting to that level are increased just purely because you're faking it until you make it, as they say.
I'm interested, David. Do you ever have a match where the second team plays the first team?
Every now and again, we have a inter-club game, but that's a bit of a mess around, between us at the end of the season. I know a few clubs do that. Some take it more seriously than others. That we have a lot of clubs have a thing called President's Day, where the club president will select an 11 to play the first 11, and they'll, the 11 that the club president will select is often made up of players within the club who aren't in the regular first team. So yeah, you it can happen, definitely. It definitely can happen.
Okay, so for our five question section, we've got our usual five questions interview this week. We're talking to a young player called Ben Barrack, and he's written a few articles for the website. So let's have a listen to what he has to say.
What kind of cricket do you play, Ben?
Well, I played under 14 levels this year, and I played 2020 for them because that's what they play. And then on sometimes I play for a Sunday and a Saturday team, my local adult team, where you play anywhere between 40 overs, 45 overs, that sort of thing.
Who is your cricketing idol?
Well, recently it's been Kevin Peterson, just because I've seen the way he plays and the way he bats and the way he sort of thinks, and I've been reading his autobiography recently and seen how he's been put through all the stuff at NATO where they couldn't, or NATO or however it's pronounced, with the quota system, and also how he started off as a bowler, and so I've always sort of admired that, really.
What about you personally? What's the best moment you've had on the cricket pitch?
Well, in my first adult game with sort of people above my age group, I took a hat trick. I don't know how, but I just did. So, and it started off with a guy who'd been batting for ages, like 25 overs, and I was just pleased to get him out because he'd scored so much. And then I got out the two next batsmen quickly as well, and we ended up getting them from about 170 for five to 170 for eight, and then I took the last wicket as well and got them out for 200 really quickly.
That must have felt pretty good.
Yeah.
Who's the best player that you've played against?
There's a guy who used to go to my school because I go to a grammar school, which is pretty serious in cricket.
Right.
He's a guy who used to play for my school in my year group,
Yeah.
and he's been nicked by Gloucestershire under 15s, even though he's only 13 at the moment,
Wow.
because he's so good, and he's been to play for England now, and so's his brother actually, and he's pretty good. He seems to bat forever, and he's a good bowler too. So.
You must have had quite a bit of coaching being, going to a serious school and, a local club and all the rest of it. So what do you think makes a good coach?
A good coach is somebody who's sort of interacts with the players, who's sort of friendly but not too friendly. So, and I'm willing to give advice to anybody, no matter how hopeless or brilliant they are. And they need the people they're coaching to respect them, but also to like them as well. Because if you don't like your coach, then you're not going to listen to what he says and sort of rubbish everything he says. So that's pretty important too.
Ben Baruch, those are your five questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
All right, thanks, Ben, for giving us your time to answer those questions. Now, David, I've heard on the news a couple of times about overcoaching, and Shane Warne in particular has come out saying that international teams in particular are being overcoached. What do you think he means by that, and does it apply to club level players, and is there a lot of overcoaching nowadays?
Well, I think to a certain extent, Shane Warne's got a point about coaching with international players because they're people who are at the top of their game. They've made it all the way through the system. probably if you're playing international cricket, you're going to have played first class and List A cricket for some time, and you've been a professional player, so you've done a lot of coaching as you've grown up, and you've had a lot of practice with your first class team before you made it into international cricket. So to a certain extent, it becomes coaching then becomes less about the technical side of things and building up technique, and more about just helping a player get through the mental side of it, and maybe the odd technical thing here and there, but generally it's more about helping players come up with their own plans and the mental side and the tactical side and all that. So I kind of, I mean, I think it's probably a bit more complicated than just saying, a coach is what the players should go to the games on, as Shane Warne said. But what I'm thinking about really is when people talk about overcoaching younger players and how if you get a talented youngster, you don't want to coach them too much because they might become robotic and they might think about it too much and get so confused by instructions on, where to put your elbow, where to put your arm, where to put your head, that you lose whatever your natural ability is.
What do you reckon about club level cricketers though? Because I know a lot of youngsters, some of them are divided in the topic of overcoaching because they do tend to get bored during coaching sometimes, but there's other youngsters who are willing to learn how and are really keen. And I know that even in international cricketers, like there's divided views on both of them. Like I know Hayden likes to get coached over and over again, and he likes to train over and over again to get that into his mind. But Simons, on the other hand, is a different kind of player where he thinks that he just has to practice once a week and that's his coaching or training for a day for the game. So what do you think about that?
Yeah, I mean, young players, most young players in the UK and Australia at least, they'll be in a club situation where they're getting coaching from a club coach, or maybe they're playing some kind of representative level cricket where, an age group level cricket where they're getting coaching from a coach there. So yeah, that's exactly the area that I'm talking about. How much should a coach intervene with a player? The classic example is given is, well, if Malinga had been born in England, he would have had his act that action completely coached out of him, and he wouldn't have been the player that he is. I can
True.
understand that, and to a certain extent, I agree with it. But that doesn't necessarily mean that he wouldn't have been the player he is just because he had a more classical action. Maybe he would have been just as good a bowler with a classical action as he is with that round arm action that he's got. We can never know. I mean, we know now that he can't bowl with a classical action because he's been bowling like that for so long. But how, if he'd have been picked up and coached as a 9-year-old, who knows? We can't say with any confidence what would have happened. So really, when people talk about overcoaching, what they're really talking about is bad coaching, I think, because I don't think you can have too much good coaching. But the question is, what is good coaching and what is bad coaching? And as you say, some people are going to think that a minimal amount of coaching is good coaching, and sort of they're left to their own devices for the rest of the time, whereas other people want to practice all the time and can't get enough coaching. So, but I don't think that is I don't think that is to do with the amount of coaching that somebody has. I think it's to do with the quality of the coaching that they have. If someone is coached every single day and it's good quality coaching, then they're going to be a good player. If they're coached every day and the coach doesn't really know what they're doing, or maybe they're coached by three or four different coaches who are giving conflicting information, the player's getting confused, doesn't really know what to do. They're getting given a lot of technical information which they can't handle all in one go, and all the bad coaching things, and they're doing boring stuff that that they're not interested in, then that's bad coaching. That's not overcoaching.
Yeah.
That's my opinion. I don't think you can have too much good coaching.
Do you think there should be a limit on coaching? So should the coach be able to give the player some space to analyze his game or look at their techniques or their how they play themselves for a while? Or do you think that a coach should play an active role in a young player or a club cricketer's career or life?
That really depends on a lot of factors. The first thing is, how good a coach are you, and how confident are you that you can make a positive difference to a particular player? And the second thing is, what does the player want and need? Because some players need a lot of coaching to get where they want to be, and some players want a lot of coaching, but they don't necessarily need as much as they think they need. So it depends on the coach player relationship and the two different personalities of the and skills of the people involved in it. A very highly skilled coach coaching a 16-year-old academy cricketer who's playing for a first class county academy is going to that's going to be a very different situation from a dad trying to teach his 11-year-old son, how to bowl or how to bat. So that's where we get into the overcoaching debate, because what you might get is the same 11-year-old who's been taught how to bat and bowl by his dad becomes the 16-year-old who is playing for an academy. And what the dad said, because the dad had no formal cricket coaching, he just sort of knows, he's just he qualifications, he just sort of knows. He was taught by his dad, and he passed trying to pass it on, sort of thing. And he's read a few coaching books or whatever. Then you've got the very highly skilled academy coach who is then, all up with the latest methods and technologies. They come at it from a completely different angle, and suddenly the player's been told two different things about his grip, his stance, his backlift, all those things. And suddenly he's thinking, "Hang on a minute, who's right? Who's?" They start trying to work it out for themselves. Add into the mix, they think, right, well, I can't work out which one is right, so I'll just try and work it out for themselves. And then they, start adding in trigger moves, and the head position goes all wrong. It can easily go downhill very quickly. But that's not because of overcoaching. That's because too much conflicting information, and perhaps it's been badly delivered by one or both of the coaches.
All right.
But I'm interested in the opinions of other people as well. Anyone who's listening to this, if you have an opinion on coaching and overcoaching, maybe you've been feel like you've been overcoached, or maybe you feel like you've got a coach who doesn't intervene enough, or maybe you're a coach yourself. How do you strike the balance with the players that you coach? So I'll be interested in getting the opinions of people listening to this. And if you are listening, drop us an email, the usual address, which is mycricketcoach@pitchvision.com.
All right, I think it's time we get into the questions, David.
Yeah, I think so. Let's answer a few questions from some listeners.
Welcome to the questions section of the My Cricket Coach Show. Our first question is from Ben Barrack.
The same Ben.
Yeah, that's right, the same Ben from the interview. And he asks, I recently bought a batting tee. To put it simply, how do you use it? I've done the usual drives, but what other shots can be practiced? Have you ever practiced with a batting tee, David?
I have used them in my coaching, but I'm not that keen on them generally as an idea. Because I much prefer to work in small groups or pairs or something like that. And you can do drop feeds and multiple drop feeds and bobble feeds. That I feel is a lot more useful a tool than having a completely stationary ball. So I'm not too keen on that. I'm not keen on batting tees in general, and I'm not keen on rolling feeds. I like bobbled feeds, but not rolling feeds. Those are the two things that I don't like particularly personally myself. But if you've got one and you're practicing on your own, they're quite a useful thing to if you just want to go in the garden and hit a few balls off a tee, then that's not the worst thing you can do. It's it's building up a decent muscle memory, and you can do the drive, the on drive, the off drive, cover drive, and the straight drive quite easily. You can't really do the flick off the legs properly with a stationary ball, so you can forget about that one. But you can if you've got one of those quick cricket stumps. Is that what it's called in Australia, quick cricket? Or is it called something else?
Oh, I don't think I've heard of that.
Quick cricket is the game where you've got the plastic ball, the plastic bats, and the plastic stumps, and it's for younger kids.
Oh, yeah.
What is that called in
I don't know
Australia?
what they call it, but I know it's.
Is it called Kanga cricket
I
or
think
something?
it's called. Yeah, that's right. Kangaroo cricket, yeah.
There we go.
You're more Australian than me.
Okay, so quick cricket or Kanga cricket, which is just a plastic stump that goes, well, three plastic stumps that go into a plastic base. You can put the tee on, put one of the stumps in the base, put the tee on top of the stump, and then you've got a ball that you can pull or cut. A stationary ball that you can practice your pull and practice your cut shot with. Again, not ideal, but it's good for shaping the muscle memory. So, it's okay. There's not really much else. There's not really much else you can do with a tee. It's the classic problem. We've spoken about this before, isn't it? It's the classic problem of what can you do on your own? What sort of practice can you do on your own? Well, the answer is not much. But there's a few simple things you can do, and you can make it a game as well. Because mark an area on the wall or something, and say, right, I'm going to hit 10 balls off the tee, see how many of them I can get into that area that I've marked on the wall, and make it into a bit of a target practice game or something like that. And you can have a bit of fun, but don't take it too seriously because you can't really do too much practice on your own.
Have you ever tried throwing a ball into the wall and batting with it, David, or like Bradman used to do, the golf ball and the stump?
Yeah, that's good for sort of hand-eye coordination, general that kind of thing. So that's all right as well. You can do it. Don't have to use a golf ball and a stump. You can use a tennis ball and a small bat, or you can use a golf ball and a small bat, or if you're getting really good, you can use a tennis ball and a stump. So that's not the ideal practice because it's not that realistic. But it is, hand-eye coordination. It's okay. It's okay. It teaches you how to find the middle of the bat, which is always a good thing.
All right, our next question is from Cricket Nut, and he asks, I have a 17-year-old fast bowler who's great downhill but loses a great deal of speed and a bit of accuracy when bowling uphill, as he says he can't get any rhythm. Is there anything I can do to help him? Is it a case of strengthening and conditioning, or does anyone have any tips for improving his rhythm? David, do you reckon that the only way for the fast bowler to get used to this is by practicing uphill? So when he's faced in a match situation where he has to bowl uphill, he doesn't lose his rhythm or his line and length or whatever.
Yeah, absolutely. I don't think it's a strength and conditioning issue. It may be if, say, he starts well and then he tails off as his spell goes on, then maybe perhaps it's, you're getting that heavy leg syndrome, which I mean, you always get that if you're a fast bowler anyway. You'll always get those heavy legs at some point in your spell, unless you bowl, three over spells. But if that's coming on too quickly, then yeah, it could be a strength and conditioning thing. You should have a look at doing some kind of improvement in leg strength by either getting in the gym or doing some of that sort of strongman stuff that you see, like pushing sleds and all that kind of thing. But it's probably not that. It's probably because when you're running uphill, it's that little bit harder, and also it makes a difference to the length of your stride, because you can't stride out as long as you normally can. You have to have shorter strides. That upsets your run up, which can upset your rhythm. And of course, fast bowling, a big portion of fast bowling is about getting into a good rhythm. So if you can't get into a good rhythm because you're running uphill, then the only way you're gonna be able to get into a good rhythm is to practice by doing some uphill bowling in practice sessions. A good way to do it is to overload the system. So instead of just bowling on roughly the same sort of hill that you see in games, bowl on a much, much steeper hill. Practice bowling on a much steeper hill than you would ever see in a match. You know, you could get ridiculous if you like. You know, find the steepest hill you can find, and you don't actually have to bowl a ball. Just run up and go through your action, and then suddenly, when you're on the very, very slight hill, suddenly it doesn't feel like a hill at all, because you've completely overloaded your system by bowling on a much steeper hill. So that would be another technique to use, and yeah, basically, as you say, Kevin, just practice. As I find a lot with a lot of these questions, the answer tends to be, well, just keep practicing
Practice.
until you get it right. There's no shortcut. There's no shortcut to a lot of these, and it's the same with this one. There's no secret, super secret method to some. You know, there's no one thing you can say to someone that will suddenly make them click. Aha! I've worked it out. They have to work it out for themselves, because so much of cricket is about the feel, the timing, and the rhythm and the feel. And it's just the same with running uphill. Or make sure that he never has to run uphill. Get him the senior bowler in the side, and then he gets to choose the end that he wants. And it's all downhill all the way.
Because I know how he feels. Because about 2 years ago, when I was about the same age, actually, we went to Melbourne and we played on our first. It was the first real cricket pitch I played on, and I was given the opportunity or the, I don't know, the threat to bowl uphill, and it was the first time I've done that as well. And I really struggled. I couldn't land anything in place, and my mind totally wavered. But yeah, I just found out I had to practice. So I just had to find a net that was slightly uphill and try and bowl in that and practice. But yeah, once you practice, your body gets used to it, so it's not a shock next time you bowl.
No, that's right. And it is hard. You know, I don't want to take away the fact that it's hard. We played a pre-season game this year on a pitch where the quite a you know, it's quite a well-defined slope, and it was like two different games going on at two different ends. The downhill end, the bowlers were steaming in, the ball was, you know, bouncing nice and high, and good hard track, and hard to score runs, and you know, beating the bat regularly and all that. Then the other end, the bowlers were huffing and puffing up the hill, and they were bowling, length was all over the place, and you know, the guy was, their opening batsman hit three or four sixes in the first two overs at that end, something ridiculous like that. And it was like watching two. It was like watching, literally like watching a game played on two different wickets, and it was, and there wasn't any difference between the ends of the wicket itself. It was because one bowler was huffing and puffing up the hill, and the other bowler was steaming in down the hill. I feel for the fast bowler. Being a wicket keeper, you do feel for the fast bowler, because I think the fast bowler and the wicket keeper probably have the hardest time physically. Out of all positions. So I think we've got a sort of a relationship there, fast bowlers and wicket keepers.
Our next question is from Kishan Dave,
Yeah.
and he asks, I really want to acquire information on specific warm-ups and cool-downs for a cricket bowler, as I always ache after bowling. I'll tell you, David, what I usually do is my two problem areas in my body, which I've identified over the last couple of years, are my shoulders and quads. So I spend extra time on them, stretch them completely, and I do the other normal warm-ups. But for cooling down, I just normally have a light jog at the end and a light stretch as well. Is there anything else I should be doing as well as what Kishan has asked?
Well, it depends what's causing the ache in the first place. It could be that he's not fit enough, in which case all the warm-ups and cool-downs in the world aren't going to make any difference at all. Because if you're not fit enough, you're not fit enough, you're going to feel it the next day. So let's talk about that first. Really, what he wants to be doing is doing plenty of bowling. That's very, very important. But it depends what sort of bowler he is on that respect, because if he's the type of bowler that doesn't get a lot of overs, because he, you know, maybe he's an all-rounder, or he's a change seamer or something like that. He doesn't always get a bowl, then that can be difficult. But if you can bowl some overs during the week, you know, between the games as well, to try and get as many overs in your legs as possible. That's what the old pros talk about, getting overs in your legs, and then combine that with fitness training. So you know, do plenty of interval training and get in the gym and start working on your leg strength and your upper body strength and your core stability, just to make sure that it's not a fitness thing, a general fitness thing. But assuming he's okay on that front, then a warm up is a very important thing. As a general rule, you should warm up for between 15 minutes to, well, half an hour, maybe 45 minutes as a warm up before you play. The older you are, the longer you're going to need to warm up. So you, Kev, would need less time than me because I'm 33 years old, so I need a bit more time to get loose and get the blood flowing to the parts of the body that you're going to need. But that warm up doesn't, I'm not talking about doing a 45 minute jog around the outfield. That warm up can include a lot of things in there which don't feel like a warm up, but are just, part of sort of general preparation. So you can include then sort of some fielding drills and some skill pr and some skill work. Like me, I'm a keeper. I always get someone to with a tennis racket and a tennis ball to hit me some tennis balls to just sort of get my hand-eye coordination going and give my soft hands, because the tennis ball it can bounce out quite easily. So I just have a few, just have maybe a dozen balls hit at me different directions with the tennis ball, so I can just get that feel for catching the ball nice and soft and comfortably. Then we can do some, you can do a general warm up where you do some active stretching, get the heart rate up, maybe do a few, not too many, you don't want to kill yourself, but maybe do a few sprints at the end, maybe 4 or 5, 10 to 15 meter sprints, turn it into a race between your teammates if you want to make it more interesting, just to sort of get the whole nervous system firing, so you're ready then to go, and that can take up to 45 minutes. Especially if you're older, you want to sort of slowly ramp it up. You don't want to just go straight from nothing to herring around the outfield. You want to start with some gentle stuff and then just gradually build up the intensity until you get to the sort of peak of it with the sprints and the fielding drills and that kind of thing at the end of it. That'll help. There's cool down is important is a is an important thing, but it doesn't necessarily stop muscle soreness, especially the stretching side of it. There's no real evidence that static stretching, where you're sitting or standing and doing a holding a stretch for 30 seconds or whatever it is, there's no evidence that that reduces soreness. So, but it's a good thing to do generally, because the more flexible you are, the better in general speaking, and the cool down is the best place to do static stretching. But one thing that I've discovered this season is the foam roller. Have you ever seen a foam roller, Kev?
Yeah, I've seen foam rollers.
Okay,
How do you use them?
I've just got I've got my foam roller here in my hand. It's I would say about half a meter in length. It's just a cylinder of made out of compressed foam, and you use it to massage your muscles, your large muscle groups. So in my case, although I try and foam roll all of them, I particularly focus on my calves and my quads, because those are the areas that are the most sore after playing, and it makes a huge difference. Just say, for example, putting the foam roller down on the floor and putting your calves on it, and then rolling your calves up and down it, so it acts as a massage, if you like, and really sort of improves the quality of the muscle tissue in that particular part of the body. And it really does sort of get rid of all the tension and the knots and reduces the soreness. Definitely reduces the soreness. But you can't do it with areas like, say, your ribs, or your shoulder blade, but you can do it with the muscles around your ribs and your shoulders. So, say the latissimus dorsi, which is the big muscle on the back, the wing type muscles on the back, and the rhomboids, which are the muscles in your back. which is a big muscle in your back, and the thoracic spine is another area that you can mobilize very well. So you can do, and you can all the big muscle groups you can foam roll. So it's definitely worth investing in one. It costs between 10 and £20. What would that be in dollars, Kev?
About double the amount.
But,
I think it's slightly cheaper here. It should be about the same here as well. So $10 to $20.
$10 to $20. Well,
in
that's quite a
Australia as
bargain.
well.
That's quite a bargain, that.
Yeah.
So I'm living in the wrong country, obviously. Yeah. So 10 to 20, and they, I mean, they last. You know, as long as you look after them, they last pretty well. And it just takes a few minutes, a couple of times a week. Although when you start, you can't stop. It's one of those things where you think, "How did I survive without this for so long?" And you want to do it every day. But yes, I mean, you only need to do it a couple of times a week. I do it the night before a match and the day after a match, and then I do. And then if
All
I
right.
feel a bit of soreness in the week or whatever, maybe I'll just do my calves quickly in the week or whatever, just to a quick 5, because it only takes 5 minutes. I mean, if you do
Yeah.
the whole body, you could probably spend an hour doing it. But I mean, you only need to spend 5, 10 minutes doing it. So I would definitely recommend the foam roller.
Yeah.
That is my new thing for this year, the foam roller. So to summarize, it's foam rolling, a cool down afterwards, because you don't want the blood pooling in your big muscles. So you know, a nice sort of jog or walk around the outfield for 5 minutes, just to get your body nice and relaxed, and do some stretching. Stretch. Ideally, you should stretch every day. It can be hard for some people to find the time to do that, but you know, stretch at least a couple of times a week. And yeah, make sure that your warm up is a nice gentle rise from very simple gentle activity up to full pace, and take as much time as you need to do that. It can take as little as 15 minutes, or it can take as much as 45 minutes if you're getting a bit creaky like I am. I have to start my warm ups on Friday night with my foam rolling. So that's how long my warm ups take. I have to start it the night before.
All right, let's rewind and get a recap of what we've looked
Yeah.
at so far. We've looked at the batting tee and if it's beneficial or not. David says that it can be helpful, but it's not too beneficial. You can practice drives or put it on a Kanga cricket plastic stump and practice pulls and cut shots, or you could use a golf ball and a stump for hand-eye coordination. But yeah, there's nothing. It's really hard to
Yeah.
practice by yourself. And we also looked at fast bowling up a hill. Is there anything you can do to improve your rhythm?
Yeah.
Well, practice is a key word. And that if a bowler struggles early in a spell, then you can tell that they need more strength and conditioning. So that's an area to look at as well. And on topic of warm-ups and cool-downs, the first thing we looked at was getting fit, because being unfit won't help you. And to do that, you could try interval training, or you could go to the gym and work out your legs, upper body, and core stability. And for your warm-ups are ideally half an hour to 45 minutes, and more if you're the older you get. And in those warm-ups, you could incorporate fielding drills, skill work, a few sprints here and there. And for your cool downs, David highly recommends the foam roller, where you could use it to massage your large muscle groups, such as your quads and your calves. Just put it on the floor, then put your calves on it and roll it up and down. And David says that it gets rid of
Definitely
tension
does.
and knots. So yeah, thanks, David. If you want, you guys can subscribe to us on iTunes, subscribe to the podcast. And are you following my coach on Twitter? Well, what are you waiting
Yeah.
for? Get on and subscribe. And if you guys have any questions, please email us at mycricketcoach@pitchvision.com.
And that's also the email address if you've got any opinions about overcoaching. We were talking about before, if you want to put your oar into the debate about overcoaching and what your experience is of coaching, or good coaching or bad coaching, or overcoaching or undercoaching.
Yeah, that's right. Thanks for listening, guys. I'm Kevin Sampath from Australia, signing off.
And this is David Hinchliffe in the UK.